You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture, to you, we pour libation, ashe. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children, we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
What you are calling African history and Negro history are the missing pages of world history. Then he said, son, go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respectful commentary of the history of the world. Well, my earliest impressions of them was a people in power who intended to stay in power, and I began to wonder why they had so much and other people had so little, and why everybody I knew worked harder than they. Who made this arrangement? I studied European history and world history. Now, when I went back to Schomburg with some knowledge of background of European history, now he began to show me how to study African history. Arthur Schomburg taught me the interrelationship of African history to world history. Willison Huggins of the Old Harlem History Club taught me the political meaning of history. And from the lectures of William Leo Hansberry of Howard University, I learned the philosophical meaning of history. The most valuable lesson I've learned is that when you address a people by their right name, that name must relate to land, history, and culture. All people go back to the geography of their original origin and identify themselves, no matter where they live on the face of the earth. We have overused the word black because black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. You can call an Italian white. That don't tell you anything about him. We are the only people who seem to have lost that all essential trait.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and I welcome you here this Tuesday evening for our normal Black Reality Think Tank program. We are so happy that you have been able to join us. We appreciate your patronage, and we thank you so much for all of the input that you give to our program as well. We thank you so much for that. Tonight we are here to talk about a very high and multi-dimensional individual. We all know him. He's known as the great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And tonight we're going to take a look at something very unique that has recently been discovered in his research about him, and that is the fact that Dr. King may very well have embraced the Pan-African idea, and as some may say, you may have been able to call him a Pan-Africanist. And so we're going to talk about that tonight. That's very unusual, obviously, based on some of the things in the past that we've heard about Dr. King. But that's the thing about history. It's ever-changing, and it changes sometimes from generation to generation. Sometimes it changes from year to year. it based on whoever is given the in-depth research and understanding, hopefully, of the ideas that they have brought forth, and trying to enlighten us with new ideas and things about subjects and people, places, and things. And so tonight we are going to take a look at Dr. King from a different perspective and talk a little bit about him with our panel and look at the research that has been recently done. As always, this is a call-in format, and you can give us a call here at 215-490-9832. And I repeat, 215-490-9832. And so for our internet audience who would like to give input, ask a question, make a comment, we welcome you to call us and do so. We'd like to engage with our audience. We want to hear from you. We don't propose to know everything, but we are here to stimulate thought. This is a think tank, and we are here to look at the history of our people, the ideas of our people, to understand the things about our people from a think tank perspective. And so we welcome you to call us and give your comment and talk about those things that we are trying to discuss tonight. As always, we'd like to do our ancestral profile. And tonight I thought I would look at a sister that has been dear to me over the years. I've enjoyed her. She is now an ancestor. Her name is Phyllis Hyman. Phyllis Hyman. Sister Hyman was born in 1949, and she transitioned to the ancestral realm in 1995. Phyllis Hyman was an American singer, songwriter, and actress. She was best known for her singles from the late 1970s through the early 1990s, including You Know How to Love Me, Living All Alone, Don't Want to Change the World. Hyman was born, as I said, on July the 6th, 1949, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to Philip Hyman, a World War II veteran, and Louise Hyman, a waitress at a local nightclub, but raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hyman was the eldest of seven children. Her music training started when she received a music scholarship to attend the Robert Morris University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but she dropped out after 1 year there. She performed on a national tour with the group New Direction. Later, she joined All the People while working with another group, the Hondo Beat. She made her acting debut in 1974 in the film Lenny. Hyman also led a group called Phyllis Hyman and the PH Factor. Hyman's debut solo album, named Phyllis Hyman, was released in 1977 on Buddha Records. When Arista Records bought Buddha Records, she transferred to the new label and released four albums: Somewhere in My Lifetime in 1979, You Know How to Love Me, 1979, Can't We Fall in Love Again, 1981, and The Goddess of Love in 1983. Hyman also performed on Broadway in the musical Sophisticated Ladies, the tribute play for the great Duke Ellington. For that work, she received a Tony Award, and she was nominated for the Best Supporting Actress in a Musical and won a Theater World Award for Best Newcomer. In 1983, Hyman recorded the song Never Say Never Again for the James Bond movie of the same name, which starred Sean Connery. But the song she recorded couldn't be used for the movie soundtrack due to legal reasons. In 1986, Phyllis Hyman released the album Living All Alone on the Philadelphia International label. She also appeared in the movies Too Scared to Scream, 1985, Spike Lee's School Days, 1988, and The Kill Reflex in 1989. In 1991, Hyman released the album The Prime of My Life, on Philadelphia International, which was the biggest album of her career. It included her first number one R&B hit, as well as her first Billboard 100 top hit, Don't Want to Change the World. The album, her last released while she was alive, was certified gold by 1992. On June the 30th, 1995, Hyman committed suicide by overdosing on pentobarbital, in the bedroom of her New York City apartment. She was found unconscious in her bedroom hours before she was scheduled to perform at the Apollo Theater. She died 2 hours later at St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital in New York City. Hyman, who was 45 when she died, suffered from bipolar disorder and depression and had a history of substance abuse, which involved alcohol and cocaine. Two of her albums were released posthumously, I Refuse to Be Lonely, 1995, and Forever with Love, 1998. Hyman was at one time married to her manager, Larry Alexander. They married in 1978, and divorced a few years afterward. The couple had no children. A 2007 biography by Jason A. Michael titled Strength of a Woman, The Phyllis Hyman Story, discussed her past relationships with both men and one woman, revealing that she embraced the bisexual life. Phyllis Hyman. All right, very deep, sister. I know many of you, depending on your age and the era you're in, remember those smooth ballads and songs that she sang. They were very popular in my time, and I enjoyed her very much, tremendously. So we wanted to take a look at her. Now we are going to talk a little bit about, as I said, the great Dr. Martin Luther King, a extremely multidimensional individual. As I said, there's a strange thing about history sometimes. Sometimes you can study someone and hear a lot about them and formulate your opinions about them and try to answer the whys and whos and whats. But you always haven't gotten the full story sometimes because the research is so in-depth and there's so much possibilities. And that's why a lot of times our scholars have to keep digging, and they have to keep researching, they have to keep looking. And you just can't go with what you were first told. And you have to remember that, particularly in the African-American tradition of history and storytelling, a lot of it was not done by our people and not by our scholars. They were done by outsiders. And what you get sometimes is you get another viewpoint that's not real, a viewpoint that satisfies the writer. As you know, the old saying, you will never know the story of the lion until he tells his own story. But most of the time, the story of the lion is told by the hunter. So we want the story from the lion. And so a lot of times there's more in-depth. And tonight, I have looked at the work of a brother that is writing for the well-known African Studies journal, is a journal that put out by the ASCAC organization, Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization. And he has developed a piece of history, and I have been reading it now for the last week, and it's a very lengthy article. But very, very good. And he's dealing with a lot of issues about the great Martin Luther King and things that, you know, I mean, I must say we really did not know, but his research has helped us tremendously. And tonight we're going to take a look at him. The article that he wrote is called An Unbroken Bond, The Role of Africa in Martin Luther King Jr.'s Liberation Thought and Practice. An Unbroken Bond, The Role of Africa in Martin Luther King Jr.'s Liberation Thought and Praxis. And the writer's name is Samuel T. Livingston. And he is, again, as I said, he's writing in a publication called The Compass. The Compass is the journal of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization. And that happens to be a journal that I can kind of feel safe in looking at what's being said, what's being done, and the purpose of why it's being done. And so I appreciate that. And so I wanted to share that tonight with all of you here, the Black Reality Think Tank, our audience as usual. This is kind of the format that we want to do tonight. I'm going to very briefly just give a real brief commentary, and then I want to open up the line to have you comment and present the possibilities of what you might think about this research. So what I want to do is just call into question a few of the points from the author. Recommend that you highly take a look at it. I will tell you where you can find it, and then you can read it yourself after the program, and maybe sometime in the future we'll discuss it again and look at it. But I just want to point out a couple of real key things that maybe we had not known, and that it would definitely shed more light on the legacy of this great man, even right down to what is the possibility of why he may have been killed. And consider that. So that's what we're going to do tonight. I'm real pleased about so far as I look out on who's online. And we definitely have a wonderful group of brothers and sisters out here, and I really appreciate them. So I want to do that. Thank you, Brother Griffin, as always. Brother Griffin just texted me the location of the article, and that is the one that Brother Griffin, that I was going to share with the audience in just a few minutes. And also, I want to take a look at the resources of this article and of his research, and look at some of the publications that he extracted from this information, and I want to share that too with you, because some of you may want to go and take a look at that later on, and that's very important as well too, to look at those resources and look at some of the publications in which the researcher found out the things that we want to look at. So with that, let me do this first. I want to, first of all, define Pan-Africanism and look at, because and our article, the title of the program today is what we called it, An African-American History Cold Case. Because we kind of sometimes thought we had known all there was to know about Martin Luther King, but it's not. We can open up this case, and that came from my good brother, Brother Timothy, told me that this morning when I was talking to him. He said, so in other words, King was a cold case. I said, he definitely was. And so I thought about borrowing his concept of that and call it a cold case as we look at the fact that we could have actually called him a Pan-African. So in order to say that, I would need to, first of all, define Pan-Africanism. Now, the term Pan-Africanism was first used by a brother back in 1900 whose name was Henry Sylvester Williams. Brother Williams grasped that term and by calling together that first Pan-African conference. But some scholars indicate that the Pan-African spirit, the Pan-African idea of things, goes back much, much further than that. It goes back to, one scholar said, 1787, when the abolitionist movements and the Africans who were fighting for their freedoms in America, Britain, were looking to go back to Sierra Leone and Liberia and even Haiti and other West African colonies. And then some of the older scholars have suggested that the idea even goes back to in the B.C. realm of things, based on that socio-historical struggles that had occurred within Africa's geographical world. And so basically, however, the ideas emerged around basically the 15th century. I think that's what we can really begin to go back to. It would be very hard to go back to that B.C. because there are a lot of things you would want to take in consideration about considering that. And so although these incidents prior to the 15th century were important, and all of the other historical antecedents that we look at that occurred in Africa prior to the 1500s, such as the struggles against the Assyrians back in around 600 BC, the indigenous resistance to Rome and Greece, and later even the Arab conquest in the 642 AD. But I think, though, that really one would have to look in terms of what those ideas were more in the 1500s. And so our contemporary idea of Pan-African emerged within that 1500 time frame. It wasn't abstract struggles. They were struggles localized within the 15th century history and onwards, which, according to Dr. John Henry Clark, he said the main roots of Pan-Africanism, both in action and social thought, are nourished by the events of the 15th century. That's what Dr. Clark said. And he said the second rise, it was based on the second rise of Europe, the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade, and Western colonialization. He said that is the beginning of that. And then our great scholar, Walter Rodney, makes a wonderful suggestion, which is kind of what we'll look at tonight when we talk about Martin Luther King and Pan-Africanism. Walter Rodney said Pan-Africanism is something we must define in the struggle. Whatever you're fighting and whatever you're doing, you define that the definition of Pan-Africanism within that struggle. And so what is essential to the African uprising, the African captivity uprising struggles, is the common experience of exploitation and oppression and unity with those held in captivity. And this is the spirit with which Pan-Africanism finds its greatest strengths. So the significance of the 15th century is that prior to this period, race was not a point of human categorization. People didn't use the color of your skin as a means of categorizing things. One was not excluded or oppressed on the basis of any racial category, basically. People were socio-culturally differentiated, such as somebody might have been a Jew and they would have been separated, or a barbarian, or a Christian, or a heathen, or a pagan, or a citizen, whatever the case may be. This is the basis for that. So what this means is that at the time in history, anyone could have been held in captivity or a master, depending on his or her status. And we find that when you look in the Roman Empire and even in the Greek Empire. So you might see a polished citizen, or you might see a barbarian who was a master over a polished citizen, and so on and on. And so that's how we know that to go back beyond that is kind of troubling. And that's one of the reasons why you have heard some of the stories of the richness of Africans in Europe, and a lot of the things that did, like Shakespeare wrote about great African prince like Othello and some of the others. Well, that was because color wasn't an issue then. There's a book by a guy that wrote a book called White Over Black, and he talked about the origin of color and skin color, and he looks at some of the ideas of where that comes from. And so Pan-African then would obviously rise around the 15th century, as I said. It does things like you're looking at some of the African nations attempting to fight against the captivity of their people. It becomes an intellectual movement. Pan-Africanism, the intellectual movement, was a product of sort of like modernism insofar as the tapestry of history. We share racialized, different other kind of concepts emerge during this era. And all of this is against the backdrop of what Europe was calling itself in terms of enlightenment, the Enlightenment period. And that's another whole study in itself. We're not going to cover that tonight. And so basically, what I'm just wanted to do, so Pan-Africanism basically then is something that emerged as an agency of restoration of African subjectivity, as well as challenging the intellectual roots of colonial historiography. And so according to the intellectual formation of Pan-Africanism, it was first conceived through the works of the former people held in captivity. And so when we read the works of people like Oladao Equiano, Atoba, Kugano, John Worsworm, Samuel Cornish, who started the first black newspaper, Frederick Douglass, you're looking at those kinds of writings is the beginning of Pan-Africanism. And so very clearly, as we move later at things like through the Harlem Renaissance, when you look at people like Elaine Locke and Langston Hughes, they wrote a lot about Africa. Dorothy West, W.B. Du Bois, Rudolph Fisher, Jesse Fawcett, Wallace Thurman, Claude McKay, Sterling Brown, and all of them wrote heavily about Africa and questioned our understanding of Africa. As one poem by County Gully called, "What is Africa? Scarlet sun or scarlet sea?" And he's questioning, what do you see when you look, when you think about Africa? And so this constitutes basically the intelligentsia and the ideas of intellectual Pan-Africanism. And it translates into the political agitation and action as we moved into the 20th century. So when people were beginning to fight to knock down segregation coming out of captivity, particularly in America, in 1865, moving on into the 1876, they were fighting this idea. And a lot of it was being motivated and generated through the struggles of African people. Even as you look at the Haitian Revolution, you're looking at Pan-Africanism in action. And even as Marcus Garvey comes to the forefront, again, as he talks about his Back to Africa movement and a lot of the ideas of the UNIA movement, you're looking at the ideas of Africa as our centrality of hope and liberation. And it's from that that Martin Luther King will emerge. The black church was very active in the African revolution of things. Henry McNeil Turner said that God was a black man. He was black. And he said that at the turn of the century. And he was very adamant about that. And then as those Pan-Africanism conferences began to start, Henry Sylvester Williams and some of the others in London and places like that, the message would become Africa, back to Africa. And even as you looked at what was known as the Negro Colored Movement, the Negro Convention Movement, where all of these conventions were being held throughout the country. And what am I talking about? I'm talking about like 1902, 1910. They were meeting, coming together as groups and thinkers. They were think tanks that were coming to do of what are we going to do for the liberation of African people. And that's what is, you go back and you look at the agenda of some of those meetings. And who you would see is a lot of cases, those powerful community people who were fighting and looking to make sure that, African people received the kind of liberation that was necessary, for their salvation. And that's where it starts. So I think that we can make a very good argument that Martin Luther King's training, and this is what the author does, Martin Luther King's upbringing is coming out of that system of things. King, when at the time when in Atlanta, where he lived. And not only just King. Let me do it this way. Let's look at a lot of us. A lot of us that were born in the 40s, the 30s, the 50s, were born into communities that were really very similar to African way of life. I was born in the South, and I lived in a community that was very, very communal in spirit. And people act like African people. We treated each other kindly. We helped each other when you needed help. If somebody was sick, we brought you food to the family. They cared for people. Nobody had to basically suffer in the community in that way. We suffered from segregation and white racism, but not in the way that you would as just a human being, because we looked out for each other and we took care of each other. And so King was raised in that kind of community as well. And his parents, his father and his mother and his grandfather and his grandmother, both maternal and paternal, came out of that system. And so what they taught and nourished him is this loving spirit of things, which was very African in nature. And even to the point of fighting back. And that's a discussion that, you know, you would have to make in another way, but that was taught out of that generation of people. And the main thing is that they would not overlook the brothers that lesser. Just because you had a degree did not mean that you overlooked your brother or your sister. Degrees were not necessarily designed to talk about how much you know. Degrees were designed to get you a job. What you would know and learn would be taught from your community, your personal drive, and the things that you can do. That's how you would get what you know. So, brothers and sisters, I think we have to take a look at that as we get ready to discuss Dr. King and what he looked at in terms of his work. So, Brother Livingston, Dr. Livingston, in this piece of work, begins in that light. He comes from just where I was talking about. In his abstract, and I'm going to read it directly from his abstract, he says, the goal of this essay is to recast the development of Martin Luther King's socio-political thought and activism in light of an African-centered reading of history. This goal involves examining the role of Africa, diasporic, and continental Africans in shaping Martin Luther King's World House ecumenical theology and his socio-ethical philosophy by first examining his cultural and intellectual foundations. Secondly, critically reading his engagement with Dalit subjectivity relative to the Gandhian philosophy. And thirdly, discussing how his African engagements were his primary form of internationalist World House praxis. The author's African-centered analytical framework seeks new ways of engaging King in the context of African cultural identity and socio-political thought. And see, the problem here is that many of us have criticized and hit heavily on Dr. King's, first of all, because he was a preacher, and he belonged into the Christian church, and so he was attacked many times for that reason. The other reason is that they said that because he embraced integration, that he did it, and so they attack him on those grounds. And basically they feel that he made mistakes in the civil rights movement, and he has been attacked on many levels, particularly from our community. And I think this article says something different. We must be conscious of what's called, historians call, presentism. You cannot judge history on present state of affairs. You cannot do that. And we've said that many times here in this format. You cannot judge the past based on things right now. Dr. King was operating in the 1940s and 1950s. Anything that he would have to do regarding Africa or anything of that nature would have to be low-key, obviously because of that ruling hand that was pressuring African people throughout America. And what had been pressuring them throughout America since the 1600s. And so that we have to take in consideration. Dr. King did visit Africa. He went there. He spoke with the dignitaries and the powerhouses of Africa. He met with them. I can imagine what the conversations must have been like. He did write about some of those in later months about that whole idea. There's a well-known quote from Dr. King that he made in January in 1965. He said, "Our heritage is Africa. We should never seek to break the ties, nor should the Africans." And so he looked at that in ways. Now, obviously, he was trained in white universities, Crozier Theological Seminary, but he did go to Morehouse, and he was there in that bastion of knowledge with the great Benjamin Mays, who was clearly an African brother. And if any of you have ever read the works of Benjamin Mays or listened to the language of Benjamin Mays, you're listening to an old African priest as he dispensed his knowledge and wisdom to all of those young men who would come through Morehouse. He worked and had an opportunity to be under the tutelage of people like Howard Thurman, and Howard Thurman, powerful African priest brother. They all were Christian ministers, but they knew how to handle that based on the time in which they lived and the time in which they worked in a way that did not interfere with their ministries and reaching out in the way that they needed to do. And so I think that's some things that we have to realize. There was a book written by a guy named Houston Baker, Jr., and it was written in 2008, according to the author of the essay, and it's called Betrayal: How Black Intellectuals Have Abandoned the Ideas of the Civil Rights Era. Now, that's another cold case that has not been looked at real good. The Civil Rights Era is looked at, when we see the Civil Rights language, we begin to talk about it, we look at things like the Birmingham church bombing, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and watching those policemen beat them. Women, men, children going across that bridge. And we kind of surmise, well, this was the civil rights, but there was more to civil rights than just those things. There were ideas. There was an intellectual component. There was a cultural component. There was obviously the political component. It had many dimensions, just like most of the people that were leading it. And we haven't really safely studied all of them. There's one historian that I think has done a great job on the history of the civil rights movement, and his name is Claiborne Carson. And this writer takes a lot from Brother Carson's work. And one of the things that I think a lot of people miss and overlook is that a lot of the work of the civil rights movement was done under the cover. It's what I call backdoor politics. There were people that shook hands and worked with each other that we didn't know about. There were people that are well known to have interacted with each other and sat down and talked to each other and strategized to each other, who were really from different sides of the fence in terms of the black struggle. Ask yourself this question. Stokely Carmichael, we've heard him say black power and talk about black power, but Stokely wanted to work with Dr. King. He attempted to do that, and they did work together. SCLC and SNCC worked hand in hand. And if you listen or read some of the things that Stokely has said about King, and they were against the integration, they didn't believe in that, but that's just a strategy. That's not the civil rights movement. Integration versus black liberation or black nationalism is a strategy. That doesn't make up the movement. The movement is something else. There's some more stuff in there that we are not taking in consideration that is very important. I know that some of us get, are upset because the fact that they preach Jesus, and we struggle with the concept of a Jesus, whether you perceive him as black or white, But I can assure you that the majority of a lot of those old black preachers coming out of the South, preaching during those times, knew of the black Jesus and preached it and processed it in the black Jesus. But obviously, the 40s and 50s, they can't publicly say that. Many of them were in denominations not controlled by African people. Basically, the Baptist Church was. And very clearly, one of the key individuals that really, you want to talk about African religion embedded into Christianity, is the work of Bishop C.H. Mason of the Church of God in Christ. Total African. But again, 1940s and 50s. And Bishop Mason was so sharp and so bright with the work he did, he got white folks to join him. And white people start coming to the Church of God in Christ services and participating, and they formed together. And they had hundreds and hundreds of people in church. And then the white folks of those communities couldn't stand that and told them that they can't meet like that no more, and forced them to separate, forced the whites to go somewhere else, the blacks to go somewhere else. And the whites that separated started their own church called the Assemblies of God. But basically, the Assemblies of God started out of the Church of God in Christ, which was really African. Even right down to the liturgy and the way that they worshiped. If you've ever gone to a Church of God in Christ, one of the things you will hear them do a lot is hum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of that is African principles and ideas incorporated in that, and techniques. And you would have to study and bring that together. We're not trying to do that tonight, but very clearly, that's where they're coming from. So what am I saying? What is point? It's easier once we look at it, as the brother said, from an African-centered perspective, and we look at the church, the black church, from an African-centered perspective, and stop trying to accuse everybody of being a white man's religion, and realize that there's a more deeper message to all of that. You would then can see a lot of where the possibilities might be with what the black church is and what it does. Now, obviously, in a lot of cases, the leadership of the church may go off track, but like anything else, they go off track. But it doesn't make it the basic concept of it. And then one of the other things, and then I'm going to stop and let's open up and talk about it a little bit among ourselves, was King's upbringing. As the author said, he wanted to tie that together with a lot of the teaching and look at that. As I remember I told you in the abstract what he said he was trying to do here. He wanted to examine his cultural and intellectual foundations. He wanted to look critically at his engagement with the Dalit, which is the Indians out of India, the subjectivity relative to Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi philosophy. And that's another thing. We criticize King for messing with Mahatma Gandhi because he says he's a racist. But where was Mahatma Gandhi working? He was working in Africa. And he was getting a lot of those principles and ideas of what he was bringing to that idea for Africa. And so a lot of the ideas, that's the idealistic principle part was coming from out of that. And then he also said, the author said, he wanted to then at that point discuss how African engagements were primarily a form of international world house practice. And that's true. Anytime you want to formulate a real fight, you got to bring it to the world. You got to get the world involved. You just can't do it from your little corner of the world. You got to get everybody, because everybody suffers under the same thing, oppression. And Europe has been the main culprit in doing a lot of that. So you can get Latin America. You can get Africa. You can get Asian world, and all come together in an international forum and fight that. And so obviously the longest and the largest body to do it is Africa. It has more to provide to the world than anybody. And that is one of the reasons why when you start trying to talk about working together and harness the pulling people together in a Pan-African way, you raise the ire of power. They're coming for you, boy, because they can't do that. They can't stand to see Africa be embraced in that way because of those resources that are there. So, but anyway, the author of this article talks about King's upbringing, and he does it in a way that's really, really interesting. King lived on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. If you, any of you that have ever been there to his house and been over to that area, and the King Center, and looked at that, it was known at the time that King lived there as Sweet Auburn. It was called the Sweet Auburn Community of Atlanta. And this was a neighborhood that was described by, I talked to you before, the brother Baker, as Little Africa. That's what it was called during that time. It was called Little Africa. It was a community like that, very similar, in Louisville, Kentucky. And both Sweet Auburn of Atlanta and Little Africa, you know, shared that same communal and aspiration way of life. And the man that was leading that community was King's maternal grandfather, whose name was Reverend Adam Daniel Williams. They called him A.D., Reverend Adam Daniel Williams. And his father, Martin Luther King Sr., and his mother, Alberta Williams King, and Morehouse College President Benjamin Elijah Mays were all a part of the shaping and molding and characterizing that Little Africa. And that church that sits right over there around the corner from King's house called Ebenezer, which is now has always been a powerhouse, a bastion of Black liberation theology, came out of there. When James Cone first introduced the principles of Black liberation theology, he did it at Ebenezer and talked about it, because that was the perfect place to do that. And so the author goes on to talk about, that was a Black world right there in Atlanta, Georgia, that was able to defend that community against white supremacy and other little acts of behavior that white crazy white folks were doing in Georgia. And they were successfully able to do that. It was formed an environmental social construction, Baker said, that suggests that understanding Black particularity must take place relative to the lived spaces where experience is made. And so, like in other areas of King's philosophy, he has always understood the concept of the least of these. I was told by several people, individuals. I know Dr. Bridges, who comes on quite often, and I had talked about a conference that was being held over Zoom, where they were talking about the great the brother that wrote the book Jesus and the Disinherited, and that book talked about the least of these. So those individuals that were shaping and molding that community understood the least of these. And then even the home training that he received, I don't know if any of you have been up to King House. It wasn't anything elaborate. It wasn't a mansion. Actually, it was a shotgun house. You could look in the front door and look straight out to the back door in where King lived. It was upstairs. And we know it was neat and clean. Black preacher, he, you know, was okay, but they weren't trying to necessarily look at being elaborate about life. The author goes on to say that a lot of what is enshrouded into the King philosophy and the philosophy of the Sweet Auburn community and all of those old-time preachers can be compared to a commissioned king called Pitahotep. And he went on to say that even Dr. King had read the works of Pitahotep. One of the interesting factors is to take a look at Dr. King's library and what books that he read to tell you how he was molded and shaped in his private study, not what the university told him to read. So that's why I've said often, stop worrying about having degrees. That ain't what does it. It's your personal reading. Most of what I know about my history and African culture, I didn't learn in the university. I learned it on my own private reading. So that's not what shapes and molds you. And the books that Dr. King read would surprise you. And tonight we won't discuss, we may discuss it at some other time, but very clearly it does. And he said that just, and this is the last thing, and then I'm going to move on, that Pitahotep, to whom King in 1948 attributed the origin of the Bible's parable genre. He said the idea of telling a story in the Bible came out of the commission philosophy system of Pitahotep. And this is what he said. He said, oh, I'll tell you this morning, and he's saying this in a speech, oh, I'll tell you this morning, and you learn this, and you discover the meaning of God's image. You'll know what the New Testament means when it says, I revealed it to babes, and so often withheld it from the wise. It says, sometimes Aunt June, on her knees, can get more truth than the philosopher on his tiptoes. And yes, and this is what all men are made in the image of God. Tell us, we must believe this, and we must live by it. That's powerful. Real powerful. Sometimes Aunt June on her knees can get more truth than the philosopher on his tiptoes. And I think that's a good ending note for us to open up our line. It's at the top of the hour. I'm going to take a quick break, come back, and let's see what you all have got to say about this idea. And then I very much encourage you to read it. I'm going to give you the full case of where it can be found, talk a little bit about some of the resources too, and then let's see what we got going here. So let's take a quick break and we will come right back.
I just returned from Africa a little more than a month ago, and I had the opportunity to talk with most of the major leaders of the new independent countries of Africa, and also leaders in countries that are moving toward independence. And I think all of them agree that in the United States, we must solve this problem of racial injustice if we expect to maintain our leadership in the world and if we expect to serve as a moral voice.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you, and nobody can make me do wrong. Take me for granted, leaving
time for an awakening media lineup. All About Times or Eastern Standard. On Mondays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspective with host Brother Oshi. On Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. On Monday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central with hosts Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone. On Monday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m., on the first and third Mondays of each month, Conversation Reparations. Conversation Reparations. On Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. On Fridays, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with host Brother Ocean. From 8 to 10 p.m. on Friday evenings, Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot Booker and his co-host Brother Richard. On Saturdays, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday evening, the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with host Brother Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. And on Sunday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and his co-host Brother Richard. These are our lineup times. We thank you for your patronage, and please, by all means, check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, my sisters and brothers, we are back and we are talking about the magnificent, prolific Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his mission of Pan-Africanism. One of the things I wanted to play in the top of the hour that we did play that I hope you enjoyed was the song by the great Aretha Franklin. And I played that because I am so mad and upset about that television production of her life. And we're not here to talk about that tonight, so we'll talk about it later. But I was having a conversation with Brother Lush earlier today about that madness, and want to kind of talk about it. First of all, let me say that's my opinion, and that's just one man's opinion. Maybe some of you loved it, so, but I hated that thing. Oh man! And then not only that, but some of the other stuff that's coming out. They're getting ready to go after Mahalia Jackson next. They just got to tearing Billie Holiday apart. Ma Rainey. What's going on? What the hell is we doing? What is this? So we talk about that. Like I said, I don't want to get into that conversation right now, but I wanted to bring it up. So that's why I played Billie Holiday. Why I played Mahalia Jackson. Why I played Aretha Franklin, because of the fact that I'm just angry about what is being done. And when I call him, like I told Brother Lush earlier, I told him it's called intellectual warfare. That's what it's called. And we're going to get into that. That's why I always talk about it here at the Black Reality Think Tank. And I really appreciate the energy that we have been able to bring together using this think tank. So many of us have become friends. We talk regularly. We engage in conversations off the program. And you kind of like have all formulated what I call my editorial review board. That's what I call the many of you people like us. Well, first of all, the first one that really embraces Sister Benusua Anyan, she was one of my first supporters. And so I embrace her. She's definitely on our editorial review board. And then Dr. Bruce Bridges, who is the reason I met Sister Anyan. I met him through him, and they start walking, coming, calling, and participating. Dr. Bridges comes on all the time. And then my good buddy Herbie White, Brother Timothy is on. I love Brother Timothy and input that he gives. And a lot of times he'll call me and stimulate ideas and thoughts. And that's what we need. We need to stimulate ideas. I don't mind you telling me what to do or telling me what you don't like. You know, I take it. And I think that's what's going to help us to grow and reach more people and be able to spread the word that we're trying to spread. So all of you, then we got a new person, Brother Greg Lewis, who I've known years before I ever started this radio program. Brother Lewis was one of the ones that started an organization called Pastors United. And he and I sat one day in breakfast restaurant in Milwaukee, and talked about organizing what he wanted to do. And he invited me to be the first speaker of the opening of Pastors United. And I appreciate him. I joined him. And then some of my newer people, Sister Dee Dee Conley, Sister Brother Horace, Brother Griffin, all of you make up a very powerful kind of network that we're doing. And a lot of what you do inspired me to come up with some of the topics. And then our new group of programs, the Elders, which is hosted by Dr. James. She's the coordinator of that. Horace Kraft, good buddy. Horace just came by today. We sat down and talked. And so many other friends that have been brought to the table. And I appreciate it. So that's good. We're gonna do some new things coming up. One of the ideas that came from our committee is let's start looking at books, have a book discussion about a particular topic and deal with that book. Like last week, we talked about the prison system. And so Brother Lush Coleman said, let's deal with Michelle Wallace's book one week. And I think that's a brilliant idea. Because like I told you, you know, we may have had external degrees outside of our college, but I can assure you that I learned more from the books that I used to buy from Bruce Bridges' bookstore than I did from the University of Wisconsin library. I promise you that. And I used to go into all the libraries. University of Wisconsin Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin Madison. I even took a trip, went over to Howard to go to the Spengarn. The Armistead Library in New Orleans, the New York Public Library. I mean, I'm a bibliophile, and I go to all the places where there's books and have studied and trying to get information. I learn more out of these independent bookstores, like the No Books. There was a bookstore here, Personality, Brother Earl, that I also embrace. Books out of D.C. is a bookstore out of D.C., New York, called Pyramid Books. I didn't learn them in the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. They didn't teach me that. They didn't teach me that in Madison. They taught me about Hegel, taught me about Plato, and I learned it. And that's why I play that clip by Dr. John Henry Cock. Study the history of your masters, and then that way you will understand, you know, why things are the way they are. And so that's why that's right, Brother Griffin, I'm always pushing books for us to take a look at, because that's where you're going to get your real learning and get the real thoughts and ideas of doing that. My mentor, brother by the name of Dr. E.E. Thorpe, at North Carolina Central University, taught professor of history, taught in all kind of universities, taught at Harvard, he's taught at Morehouse. He's taught all kind of different places. Dr. Thorpe used to come to class in the beginning of the lecture. He didn't have nothing in his hand but a piece of paper. And he would sit there, and I promise you, before we got out of class, he would have rattled off 50 books. And I said, how that man remember all that? you know, but that's what it does. It, there's an itch. It's kind of like an itch you get when you are studying and things hit you and you get excited. And, you know, you just can't stop yourself, you know, because it feels so good. I know many of you might have you watched that YouTube video of Thelonious Monk playing the piano. And he playing the piano, and it gets so good to him, he jump up from the piano and walk around the stool about 3 or 4 times. Well, there might be some other stuff pushing that too, but it's also that music. Ray Charles used to do that. Kick his leg up in the air. You get to playing, it gets so good to him. He'd be reeling and rocking. I remember in the movie with Jamie Foxx, one of those guys from the background said, look, he got that itch. And what I think, there's a spiritual itch to that. I watch Dr. Bruce Bridges sometime when he's on here talking. He get that itch. You can't stop him. I'll be saying, Dr. Bridges, let me ask you something. He going, you can't stop him. You don't hear me. And that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, that knowledge does. And that's what we're trying to bring forward here. Many of you have experienced that. Okay, so let's go to this discussion on Dr. King and his embracing of Africanism, and kind of look at how it's going. Let me do this. I'm going to go over here to my sister, Sister Beniswa, and ask her, because she and I have had some discussions about the black church she wants to do. She has an idea of getting a bunch of us together with clergy. Dr. Bridges introduced me to a brother that teaches at Shaw University in the School of Divinity, Dr. Maxwell. I love to get people like him. I got a brother that's a preacher. He's probably listening, maybe. I get him in here and some other folk, and we're going to talk about the black church and some of the issues that she sees. But Sister Yan, you heard much of the discussion that, you know, I talked about. I noticed you were on. Does any of this impact your belief that you've had prior to listening to me talk about this?
Well, first, I want to say Hotep and Alafia to Hotep, the family, the black Hotep family. And powerful, Doc. You know, unfortunately, I missed about the first 30 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, I ran into somebody who wouldn't stop talking, so I had to just get away from them. But anyway, I heard enough.
Okay.
As far as Dr. King is concerned, when I saw the ad, I was thinking that I don't doubt it. I don't doubt that he had Pan-Africanist leaning. And because of the conversation, let me back up.
Okay.
What you were talking about, mm-hmm, just for the last few minutes, building community. And I'm a firm, but I've done this in my activism for many years,
right,
building community with all of our differences. And I see that happening. I've watched that happen with your show, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yes, it is.
So I see everyone that calls in regularly, I see this is family and community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a beautiful thing. So anyway, I might not have much to say.
You stretching it, huh?
Huh?
I said you got to stretch it a little bit, huh?
Got what?
I said you have to stretch it a little bit, but I see you saying, yeah, okay.
Yeah, because I actually just walked in, and so I'm trying to pull my thoughts together. So you might have to come back to me.
Okay.
But what I will say is that I have come to understand that I think one of the mistakes we have made was to just blast out what we believe and what we think, knowing that we have an enemy that wants to kill us, and that they're certain that they do not want to see our unity, especially in the Pan-Africanist movement.
Right.
So when we look at the pastors that many of us will criticize, mm-hmm, for embracing a Eurocentric Bible or Christianity, we don't know what they're doing. They may, they're
right,
similar. A lot of them that I've met are spooks who sat by the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're people who are doing things. And I also see that a lot of us, and me, I'll speak for myself, when I found out that Christianity had been forced on us, because I didn't know that until some years ago, When I found out it had been forced on us and realized it had been weaponized and all of that negativity and then what it's grown into this bastion of greed and whatnot, I was angry. And I had to process my anger before I thought about anything rational. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of us are. Once we realize how Christianity has been used to do us harm,
yes, it is.
Besides being forced on us for the purpose of doing us harm, and seeing that harm manifest, the first thing we experience is anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really can't talk about this stuff rashly as maybe being, not maybe, but being used as a tool and having this, you know, articulate things in a way that is, you know, not clear so that the enemy won't get busy trying to destroy you. We got to process those emotions first. And when we do that, then we can have some pretty strong conversations about what's actually being done in many churches.
Right.
I'll end by saying, Brother Jeremiah Wright, I saw that brother preach here in Greensboro, and he blew my mind because he talked about the ancestors. And it turns out that this is a pretty popular sermon of his, but he talked about the ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about Ma'at,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that man knows what's happening.
Yep.
So does a lot of other pastors, but they can't tell everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right, you can't say that. Mm-hmm.
So we do. We need to deal with our emotional, I'll say our emotional response to what to the purpose of Christianity being forced on us, which was to enslave the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can actually start to come back together and strategize. So I'll end there.
That's right. And I remember you talking about the concept that Dr. King had called the beloved community.
Uh-huh.
You remember that? We talked about that. As a matter of fact, we did a program on the beloved community. And
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And basically, a lot of that was Dr. King's carrying out of Sweet Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. That was his community. He lived in a beloved community. You know, like I said, those folks in that community protected those kids and their people from all that racist demon that was what was around them. There was a lot of us around them. Right down on the corner of Dr. King's house is a fire station. And you know who probably worked in there. A lot of redneck firemen but they didn't bother. They didn't bother that community. It's now a museum bookstore. But that whole community where Dr. King lived on Auburn Avenue was a part of his upbringing, and that's where he came into natural existence around that. So I appreciate that, Sister Yana. I appreciate it. Let me ask Reverend Lewis, are you online? Reverend Greg Lewis, are you online? Okay. Dr. Bridges, what you think?
Yeah, take it off mute. Don't leave me now. Don't leave me. Just take me a second and take it off mute.
Okay. No, you were off. You've been off.
I've been on mute. Okay. Well, okay. At least I wasn't making any noise then. That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah, you won't make no
yeah.
noise. Okay.
Yeah, we had we you didn't let the audience know that we had a Black Rapture think tank discussion last night.
Yeah, we did. We sure did. We sure did. And as read, I don't see Sister Ann online either. She's not on yet. I don't know if she's coming on, but she's not on yet. Okay.
I guess after the other night you more are you?
right.
Yes, Dr. Maxwell called me now on this phone. I don't know why he is, because
I think he's on now.
He knows I'm okay. Good. Yeah, I mentioned, I texted him that you had just mentioned Howard Thurman, and you couldn't think of it.
Yeah, Howard Thurman, that's what I'm trying to think of.
And you mentioned his name. But I did want to, a couple of things I just wanted to mention, not many. But one thing, and relate to what Sister Ayan said, that is that Dr. King pulled the community together, even though Stokely Carmichael, he would always say that the strategies may be different, but we have the same goal, and that is the freedom and liberation of our people.
Right.
Of course, that's right. And Stokely didn't agree with agreed with Dr. King on some things, but many things he didn't.
He did,
but
right.
They still got along. When you look at all the marches with Dr. King, Stokely's there with his high bib overalls. He's marching just right there with Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing in several of the other marches, too, with H. Rapp Brown. And, of course, you know he definitely was not in agreement with King's strategies or tactics, but you know he was right there. So it does bring people together on the fact that we have one goal, as Garvey said, one God,
right.
one
That's
aim,
right.
and one destiny. Now you may want to do certain things to help reach that goal. Dr. King may do something. I may do something entirely different. But it's still, our eyes are still on the same goal. And I think that's what we as people need to remember, that we have our own ways of going about getting things done, but let's just get it done. And that's what I think is important.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yes, it's something interesting you said about Stokely. I remember Stokely went so far to say that Dr. King did some stuff that he wouldn't do when he attacked the Vietnam War. And he said,
when he made the speech.
Yeah, right. When Joker said, oh, man, he said, I knew that was it then when he said that. Because.
Right, he did. He said that, and that's a good one, too. That's one of my favorite ones. Why I opposed the war in Vietnam. And he did it. And going back to what you said about his Pan-African views, you just made me think about it. In that Why I Opposed the War in Vietnam, he talked about the North Vietnam and South Vietnam and he talked about colonialism by the French over in Vietnam, and he talked about Ho Chi Minh and, you know, and that kind of thing. So and the comments that he made on Africa. So like Booker T. Washington, Dr. King may have had some social beliefs in Pan-Africanism, but he definitely was not against it. He might didn't talk about it much, but then again, he did talk about it. He may not have discussed it like Stokely would have, but he did discuss it, you know, to a great extent, you know.
Right. One of our supporters of the Black Reality Think Tank texted me today when I put the announcement out, and he told me that he agreed with me 100%. He said because not only did Dr. King embrace Pan-Africanism, that he went and put a wreath on the grave of Marcus Garvey.
That's interesting.
That's very interesting. So I'm telling you, we got a multidimensional brother here that we may have attacked in a way that doesn't kind of add up to some things. So you're right. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Bridges. Appreciate it.
Yeah, okay, and I'm still listening.
Okay, good. We're going to make come back. Brother Timothy, I've listened to both Minister Farrakhan and to Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and... none of them have ever attacked Dr. King. I mean, in any way that I've ever heard. You ever heard them attack him?
No, I'm going to give you an example, brother, of the relationship with King and the messenger. See,
right.
When they talk about the meeting of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, they never met like that. They might have been in D.C. talking about things, dealing with legislation and politics, and they went their separate ways. The meeting was with Elijah Muhammad and Martin Luther King.
Now that's what I heard. I heard that.
That's the meeting. And when it came to the autobiographical work, Alice Haley wanted to do it on The Messenger, and Elijah Muhammad said, I got a student that I want you to do it on. That's how humble he was. The Messenger didn't care about the limelight. He said, do it on Malcolm X. And when he did it on Malcolm, Malcolm added his knowledge and his views, and he talked about the messenger. Now, you know, that is an informal autobiographical work, because Malcolm didn't finish that book.
Right.
But I'm going to say this, that you talked about a word that I use, cold case. Brother, we in a parking place of ideas of 360 degrees of knowledge.
Right.
We share. And everybody that uses words, we all one thought. We like the mother shit. You know what I'm saying? That's we in the universe.
I like that
man,
too.
Traveling.
I like that one too.
That's right. That's right. So brother, we together, and all that we use, we use it against the enemy. So we can't claim nothing but having black power.
That's right.
I'm going to say this, that how can I, with my ordinary perception, give a perception of an extraordinary man?
Right.
The king was an extraordinary man. Yeah, I mean, let me tell you something. When I studied the teachings of the messenger as a teenager, you know, late 60s, early 70s, I have a different perception of him now. Listen to me. Same thing with Malcolm. In the first resurrection, people called Malcolm a traitor, a Judas, a hypocrite. Those people ain't saying that now. A different perception as years go on. So, and when we look at Mr. Muhammad, he never wavered from what he believed in. He died in the grave saying the white man was the devil. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And I'm gonna say to you, that Minister Jeremiah, his post was in the South. He's the chief minister of the South. And he would always talk about how he became connected with J.B. Stoner and Calvin Craig. And he would say that King got it underneath their skin. They were pragmatic with Jeremiah and the messenger. They loved him. I'm not going to say they loved the messenger. They like their separative ways. But King got under their skin, man.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant something. He got, you know, he had a lot of stuff with mind strategy. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So
exactly.
King was so valuable. He connected with the American principles better than white men.
Right, exactly.
And he understood scripture, and he had a PhD in philosophy. He was a great thinker. Oh, my. Listen to me. Jeremiah said, he said that when it came to thinking and speaking, he said, King was at the top. He said, but when it came, one thing King didn't want to do with Malcolm was debate him.
Right.
Malcolm would tear him up. He knew it. He would avoid him. But we got to look at the leadership in Africa. Because what was Africans doing that time?
Mm-hmm.
You ever read any Achebe's work? With things fall apart, no longer at ease. He's more telling you about how Africa fell apart. But then you got Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who's more radical. So when you put the African with the African-American and hook that stuff up, it shows you we got to be together. Become the one force in power at that point.
Right.
So that's the goal.
That's right.
The whole goal is being who we are, Dr. Rogers. Because in America, it strips you of who the original man and woman is.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, you know, it's colonization. And if you study colonial writing, which is writing of colonialism, you got to look at people who wrote about Fanon. You got to talk about the colonial writers in Africa and connect them to what we do in America, the Black Power movement that's going on now and here and over there.
That's right.
That's my position.
That's exactly right. Thank you so much. And I, you know, one of the resources that the author uses in his book is that Dr. King wrote an article in the Amsterdam News in the early 60s, around 61, on why we need to focus on Africa. And he talked about that in detail. And you got to think about that for a minute. And particularly for us right now, the reason you got to think about that is that anybody with any kind of understanding of the way liberation movements work, and like Dr. John Henry Clark said, you got to be rooted to land. And if there's any possibility of liberation, we have to have a land force that we can deal with. Everybody's tried to tell us that. Garvey tried to tell you that. All the way back to Prince Hall. Prince Hall said we can never make it in America. Prince Hall talked about getting a ship, going back to Africa. That's what he did. That was one of the things that he did outside of the starting the Masonic Order. He started the Masonic Order to create an organization of powerful men who can operate in private and do some of the things that were necessary to do in the community of Boston, Massachusetts. And, like, he was trying to start private black schools. in 1700. This is Prince Hall. That's somebody we want to talk about one day, and looking at the work that Prince Hall was doing. They all knew that you wasn't going to make it here like that. If you're going to have liberation, it's going to have to be rooted to land that is open to you. And that wasn't open to us. America wasn't. You know, during the times of the 40s and the 50s, racism was vehement. And you just got rid of a clown that was in the White House over the last 4 years that will help to bring all of them out to tell you that they ain't going nowhere. They still here. You got people walking in the department stores, shooting down all kind of folk, you know, doing all kind of crazy stuff. Guns, 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 guns everywhere. I was talking to Brother Horace Kraft today about this gun culture. You know, guns, 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 guns. Bullets, 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 bullets. You know, you're not going to solve everything with that. You got to have them sometime for protecting, but that's not going to solve our liberation. You got to be rooted. And I think King understood that, and King knew that. Brother White, what you think about that?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, Brother White. Hotep
Tip on the show. I'd just like to say something briefly about the movies and whatnot that you were talking about earlier.
Okay.
white people have an anti-Nguzo Saba task force. It operates all the time.
All the time.
All the time.
I love it.
Now, as far as Dr. King of 1967 and 68 is a different person than Dr. King in 55, 56, and
yep.
57.
Yep.
In the Mountaintop speech, in the earlier part of the Mountaintop speech, Dr. King says, take your money out of white banks and put them in black banks.
Mm-hmm.
Take your insurance policy out of white insurance companies and put it in black insurance. They don't drink Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the United States was the most violent, greatest purveyor of violence in the world. The greatest purveyor of violence in the world. He had misidentified white people as human beings. And when he said, we are integrating into a burning house, the burning house was a metaphor for hell.
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, no doubt about that. That was another king. It wasn't another king. It was an elevated king. I would say he was mm-hmm. elevated in his thinking at that point of time. You're right about that. Right. Thank
and
you.
Either you succeed or you learn.
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Brother White. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight?
Finding yourself, Brother.
Good.
Just thank you so very much, and good evening to everyone. The question that I have to you, and it is... just wanted to let you and everyone else know it is an honor and a pleasure to be in your midst once again. And I get my feel every week by listening in, and it really does inspire me. The question that I have is, can you speak for a moment on authenticity of information that maybe we also need to take into consideration as we start to learn more about various personalities, mm-hmm. Various concepts, et cetera. What is it that we need to do, not only in this group, but throughout the diaspora, to be able to be in touch with authentic information that can help fortify the kind and type of learning that we're looking toward?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that's so interesting, because tonight, in choosing this topic, my process, is interesting in how I determine what we're going to talk about. You know, like, first of all, I listened to a lot of the ideas that you all have come forth with, that, you know, we talk about over time. And one of the things that I wanted to look at tonight, and I ended up changing my mind, is I wanted to look at Harriet Washington's book called Medical Apartheid and look at some of the things that were done, particularly now in this COVID-19 time frame that we live in. And I wanted to look at it because one of the things that we have, one of the individuals that does the elders program, Dr. Jenny James, who is an MD, and we would talk, I was reading some of the things that she was doing, and she had just written a memo to the president of the Wisconsin Medical College about something to do with, you know, doctors and training and getting more of our people involved in the process, which obviously indicates that there's a need to have more black doctors. But that's another subject. We're going to get to that a little bit later on. Right. But to answer your question, Brother Lush, I was thinking about that in terms of the scholarship that we are trying to get. The article that inspired me tonight, as I said, came out of the ASCAC Journal, which is the Journal for the Association of Classical African Studies. That's the organization founded by Dr. Jake Carruthers and some of those brothers out of the inner city studies out of Chicago and Illinois and the work that they did. And I think that might have been one of the only reasons that I decided to use that. And then when I looked at his resources, and that's the other thing that I do. When I take it, I look at their resources. I look at where they get the stuff from. It was solid. It was solid as a brick. And it was, he had citations that talked specifically about Dr. King's relationship to Africa. He had journal articles, and I'm going to give that to you. I want to make sure I give that to you before our program ends so you can take a look at it yourself. And go get it, and then if you can't find it, then you email me. I'm going to give you my email address, and then I would send it to you so that you will have it. But very clearly, that's what we have. We have to become more authentic in our research and stop talking from the hip. A lot of times we talk in hip. And please, what I'm about to say, there is no attack, and I love sometimes, I appreciate YouTube, that it does offer some good things. I appreciate sometimes some of the things that you see on Wikipedia. That is not authentic.
Wow.
Please hear me. You know, please. And we need to get into that discussion one day. Some of it is good. Don't get me wrong. It opens up basic information. But it doesn't give you the depth that we need to have to better understand why and how we are doing certain things and how, if we're going to have to change and make things happen. It doesn't do that. It can't do that for you. That only can come from the perspective of your own people, the people uh-huh. who've been there. Like I told you that quote, Aunt June, I learned more and from, like I said, I had a grandfather who was a construction worker. I think he finished the ninth grade. I learned more stuff from that man sitting on the front porch of my house in Durham, North Carolina, on Carroll Street, listening to him on Saturday night smoke his pipe and telling me about stuff.
Wow.
I learned that. We used to sit out on the front porch, and we'd look up at the sky and look at, I see the stars and the moon, and I'd ask him questions about that. And he would run it down. This man finished the ninth grade. He built our kitchen table in our house. He built the chairs to the kitchen table. They never broke down. They never cracked and split. That's the authenticism that I think we need to have had. And we don't have that. Well, we have it, but it's weakening a little bit. And we've got to bring it back to the surface. You're right. And maybe, Brother Lush, we might have to have a good old-time discussion about that authenticity situation. That old black church that sat way back in the country, that drinking water came out of well, is that old-time religion that we often have talked about. They talk more about the real truth than anybody else. That is where you learn about the Old Testament and the teaching of the Old Testament came out of that spirit of things. And where I came up, that's who taught me. Those are the people that were around. Those are the people that were telling me about stuff and telling me how to live my life and comparing and contrast that to that old time system like that.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, it's, as always, it's a pleasure to sit at the feet of you elders, and thank you so very much for
thank
sharing.
Thank you for being there.
I'll continue to listen.
And we're going to do that book club piece that we talked about the other day. We want to definitely do that. We want to have that discussion. Definitely look at Michelle Wallace's book, and so we're going to prepare for that in a couple of weeks, Brother Lush. We'll be ready to do it. Okay, let me go. Dr. James, is that you from Chicago?
It is, and I'm glad to hear, always to hear something about Dr. King, and I'm not surprised that there are things that we haven't heard before. I think he was a very selected because he was a chosen to be diplomatic. And I don't think that during his time that we were able to embrace
right.
some of the conversations about Africa at the time. But if we recognize him as being a scholar, he's been reading these things. And probably incorporated it in the things that he presented, but it is fascinating to hear it being said at this time.
Yes, right. Thank you. Thank you so much. And that's true. Yeah, he was operating in a time frame. He was, as Brother Lush said, he was authentic about a lot of the things that he was saying. And in a lot of cases, Dr. King was humble to stuff. And there were a lot of people in his ear, and he had some giants that were advising him, and these were the elders of his community and the elders that were around him. There was a woman named Septima Clark that was a big part. Dr. Bridges, what's the other sister that also coached Stokely Carmichael a lot too? What was her name?
Ella Baker.
Ella Baker, September.
Right.
Septima Clark.
Septima Clark was another one, right. That's right. Dorothy, what's her name? She was another sister, too. She's deceased now.
Where was she? She out of Alabama? Dr. Bridges, was she out of Alabama? Okay. All right.
Fannie Lou, since you mentioned Alabama, she's from Mississippi. I meant Fannie Lou Hamer, too.
Fannie Lou Hamer was a giant.
Giant. This is black. This is Women's History Month, too, isn't it? That's right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh, Dorothy Cotton. That's what I was
getting
right.
That's right. Dorothy Cotton. Oh, yeah. And wasn't she the secretary?
Right.
She was the secretary for SCLC, wasn't she?
Right.
Yeah, she was the one that handled all Dr. King's business.
And kept that's him, right. Glenn
Robinson. Him.
Yep. What'd you say, Brother White?
Joanne Robinson.
Right. Exactly. Okay, Brother Marcus, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right, brother.
Okay.
You know, he also had a Jew there, Stanley Levison, that was took care of his finance. But, you know, I don't think he was a sellout. Because sellouts usually die rich. Because when he died, it was Harry Belafonte had to bury him.
And the paper is real.
He wasn't a sellout. Yeah, he was a genuine man. Probably a little bit misdirected, but he was a genuine man. I'm not really an integrationist, but I do, you know, respect him, you know, for his accomplishments. And one significant thing, although he was non-violent, and the night they kill him, black people showed out. So, you know, that was, when they kill him, right here in Memphis, Tennessee, black people turned
they
out.
Tore that city up. That's right.
The whole America.
He tore it up. You're right.
Thank you, brother. Thank you
so much. Sister Dee Dee, you got anything to say? Any points you want to make?
Oh, yes, sir. Hello, family. You know what? I love what you said earlier, how we all you know, just became family, because I love everybody on the show.
Right.
Oh, my goodness, Sister Vanessa, I love everybody on the show. And speaking of Dr. King, I think I had mentioned to you one time where I was asking you, because you know you my Dr. Clark. So I believe I asked you one time. I was reading where Malcolm was writing letters to Dr. King to ask Dr. King to come to one of his speeches.
Right.
Or I guess, you know, well, I guess they finally did meet. But I don't believe those two brothers were really at each other the way the media used to say.
Yeah, they weren't.
But they got killed right after one another.
Right.
And both of them were murdered at the age of 39.
Right.
Both of them were 39 years old.
Right.
And Dr. King, I feel, I think he was kind of getting away to the turn the other cheek stuff.
Okay. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, there's a lot.
But they still on.
And like you said, also, you got to be careful with, what is that, Wittapikia or whatever that mess is. You got to be careful with that.
Oh, no doubt about it. Oh, no doubt about that.
Right. And you know what? Another thing, too, I want to say, then we'll get off the air. But, you know, I remember one day, show you how much I just love the family and the people on the show. Oh, my goodness. One day, I think, I don't know what had happened, though, but I know you didn't come on one day. And boy,
yeah, I heard about that. Yeah, had a meeting.
And I told the family, I said, you know what? I said, Doc gonna be proud of us, y'all. We had a ball. Well, thank you, Dr. Rogers, and I love you. And I love you, Rachel, family.
And I love you, too. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you. Brother Harris, you got any comments you want to make? And then I want to give the name of that publication where you can find this article that we were talking from today. Brother Harris, anything?
No, I'm just going to say this is a beautiful and informative program. My daughter was coming back 30 years old, and she's been in college. And she said, man, you'll never get this in college. She heard, was just listening and said, I've never heard this before. So I just thank you for just sharing the knowledge.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Yes, sir. Okay. Brother Lewis, because I had called on you before, and I didn't hear you. Did you want to say something?
Oh, yeah. Doctor.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
I just want to say how much I enjoy you and how much you have encouraged me. And, you know, you have really gave me some integrity and asking me to join you even on these Tuesdays.
Yes, indeed.
And I just want you to know we're going to work even harder to bring folks together, to build up power.
Yes, we are.
And we also are working on, you know, building power with the black and brown community, because we make up 65% of Milwaukee. And I just want you to know that I really admire you. You helped me get started. And I'm so encouraged right now that, you know, I'm just ready to go to work and do what needs to be done. And I'm just not tired at all. I just want to thank you so much.
Yes, indeed. Thank you,
my brother. A mentor and a friend.
Thank you, my brother. I appreciate that. I really do. Yes, sir. It's like Jamie Foxx said in that film, Ray Charles, you got to make it do what it do, baby. And that's what we try to make it do what it do.
That's right. Make it do what it do.
Make it do what it do.
Doctor.
That's it. That's exactly right. Well, folks, the publication that I was speaking from tonight comes out of a online site called Academia, Academia. You may have to join it. I'm not sure. I've been a member of it a long time. I think Brother Griffin, Otis Griffin, has been, because, you know, he and I have been texting tonight while we're online, because he actually sent me the link that it was on. And so what it's called An Unbroken Bond, The Role of Africa in Martin Luther King Jr.'s Liberation Thought and Practice. Here is my email address, and I can send this to you. It's Sankofa, Sankofa, think@outlook.com. I repeat, it's Sankofa, all small letters, Sankofa, think@outlook.com. Send me an email and I will send you this publication and you read it, and then maybe again we'll talk about it. But definitely, Brother White, we're going to talk about all these films that are attacking our people, the beautiful Aretha Franklin and all that mess that they're trying to say about her and her daddy, and what they said about Billie Holiday and what they said about Ma Rainey. They getting ready to go after Mahalia Jackson. They went after Sam Cooke. It's just total intellectual racism at its highest level. And I want us to talk about it as a think tank and look at, and then follow Brother Lush's example of looking at some of these books that we want to talk about and have kind of some book discussion.
Dr. Rogers?
Yes, go right ahead.
Do I have a minute?
Yes, go right ahead.
All right, because like I said, when you called on me, I had just walked in the door, so I really wasn't focused. But one thing I want to say before I get off the phone, get off the broadcast. Our people really, we have to learn from, I'm trying not to tell us what to do, right? But we have to learn from our leaders, our teachers. We have to learn the lessons of their lives, the lives that they live. Because as I've heard this great dialogue, it made me realize that I learned some very important things as I've gotten older. One is that most teachers, leaders, are in a constant process of evolving. And so where I was 10 years ago, I'm in a different place now. Mm-hmm. And somebody already said, same thing with Dr. King.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was talking about the emotional piece early on, when you asked me to share something, I want to say something else about that. Dr. King, in one of his last interviews.
I didn't want to cut you off. We were right at 9 o'clock.
Okay. So everybody look at Dr. King's face at his last interview. That man was traumatized.
Okay. All right. Yeah,
he was in a tremendous amount of pain. So let's look at the whole person, not just little snippets here and there.
And hold it. We want to talk about some of that, too. Thank you all so much. I'll see you next week. Have a wonderful and safe week. I appreciate you. Take care.
Keep in touch. Cause I'm a love man.